We had also found a surrogate in an old school friend, but getting both women to synchronize cycles was easier said than done. With huge hopes, we started treatment at a well-known fertility clinic in Harley Street. There was no reason why it should fail. Both parties had had children of their own, and both had a track record of success. My donor was still under 35, still a good age for donating. But the first cycle gave us a very disappointing number of eggs, and in the end, we only managed 8 viable embryos. Of those, only 2 were of reasonable quality. I remember looking at them through the microscope, thinking how amazing it was that these bundles of cells could eventually transform our lives. The implantation of our 2 little embryos took place. We had to wait an excruciating few weeks to see if one, or both, gulp, had implanted. I will never forget the crushing blow of discovering that neither had taken. I couldn't understand why not. Both women had children. Why was this fertility business so difficult? Had the clinic done something incorrectly? Should the transfer have been done in the dark, as I later learned was standard in another clinic? I had scaled so many mountains to get to this point, so I told myself this was a mere bump in our journey to parenthood. Hey, this was only our first attempt. Our surrogate was so disappointed and took the failure personally. I had not been expecting that. I tried to reassure her that it often failed, particularly the first go, but she felt too emotionally drained to carry on. It was indeed asking a lot of her. Without meaning to, I must have shown my dashed hopes and disappointment. It was an intense situation. I was sorry she wanted to stop, but understood. Would my friend consider donating eggs again? Thankfully, yes. But now we had to find another surrogate. Fortunately, COTS, the agency, came up trumps with a surrogate, but she lived near the Scottish border and we were in London. Still, distance didn't matter. Once visits and all the vetting procedures had been completed, which all took several months, we were anxious to get started again. But just as we were about to proceed, the surrogate discovered she was pregnant by her husband for another baby. We were hugely disappointed. She'd already been a surrogate for 2 other women, and this was baby number 7 for her. After another wait, COTS found us another angel, a lovely lady called Rebecca, who was much closer to us in London. Perfect. Once again, we went through the same implantation process. We crossed our fingers and waited to see if it worked this time. I tried not to pick up the phone every day to find out how she was. I didn't want to sound too desperate. Somehow I was totally convinced it was going to happen this time. Then, one morning, my mobile rang. I picked up the phone, nervous with excitement. "My period has started," she said quietly. "I've taken a pregnancy test, just to be sure. I am so sorry, but it hasn't worked." She told us she'd started a relationship with a new man and that he wasn't keen for her to do it again. I was floored. I pulled myself together, thanked her, and told her we should meet up for a drink anyway, but I wasn't sure what we would do next. A few months later, the lady up near the Scottish borders became available again. She had given birth to baby number 7. She was so fertile. How could it fail? Her doctor wasn't happy about her becoming a surrogate again, but she was perfectly happy to go ahead after a few months' break. I would not give up hope. We waited until she was ready. Then the 2 remaining embryos were defrosted and the transplantation took place. I remember taking her call, standing in a changing cubicle in a shop, half-dressed. I took a deep breath as I answered. Were we finally going to be parents? But it was not to be. My friend who had donated her eggs had now been through 2 cycles for us. I hated subjecting her to all these unnecessary hormones. I just couldn't ask her to do it again. It was unfair. I went over to her house. We had a long chat, and I told her I was going to find someone who could do straight surrogacy instead, without the involvement of a clinic. Besides, we just couldn't afford to do it through a clinic again. We both shed a few tears that it hadn't worked, and hugged each other. It was sisterhood at its very best. I will never, ever forget her generosity. I was simply overwhelmed by all the women who up to this point had been on this journey with me. What incredible angels there are in the world. But now Andrew and I were back at square one. We had no more embryos and no more money in the pot to fund more attempts through a clinic. Even though I was gutted, I held on to the belief that somewhere out there was someone special who could help us. One day, I would be holding my own little baby, looking into his or her eyes, feeling the love and bond between us. Please, God. Chapter 15. Devising My Metro Map. My immune system had been wiped out by chemotherapy, and several years later, it seemed I still had not fully recovered from the onslaught. In 2002, I had swapped the immune-boosting and glucose-lowering berberine for Gymnema, as I had forgotten the long list of reasons why I had chosen berberine. In fact, berberine is so effective as an antimicrobial, the army are investigating it as an anti-anthrax supplement. I reintroduced it into my regime in 2004, when my markers had shot up again, but there was still no other research I could find about it. So, with hindsight, I still failed to take it as regularly as I needed to. Instead, I looked for other ways to boost my immune system. It was in 2007, during an outbreak of avian flu in the UK that caused mass panic and hysteria, that I discovered cimetidine as an immune booster, also a potent anti-cancer drug. I was concerned that if I did pick up a potentially deadly bug, such as avian or bird flu, I might fare worse than others because I was struggling so badly to fight off any infection. I was picking up one bug after another. They would lay me flat for weeks. Despite defeating cancer, I was not thriving. I was merely surviving. Perhaps I had to reboot my innate immune system from scratch. Maybe it needed to relearn how to react to colds and flu. Perhaps the trick was to build it back up again slowly, allowing it to relearn how to recognize pathogens. But this approach wasn't working. Every cold was as bad as the last. I was not building up my immunity at all. I discovered that my Th2 immune response, the humoral response to allergens, was permanently raised. This was what Dr. Kenyon had tested, my IL-5 result. It was this that was preventing me from raising my Th1 pathogen response to opportunistic infections. When one goes up, the other drops. Antihistamine drugs helped reverse this problem by dampening the Th2 response. It allows the Th1 response to come back up. Research showed cimetidine would do just that. It was an old drug, no longer available over the counter in the UK, despite being liberally prescribed in the 1980s for gastric ulcers. It was still available in other countries, like Germany and the US. I should have asked one of my friends in America to buy it and send it over to me, but instead, I used an online pharmacy in Canada. As it was an antacid, I used it for just 3 months, as I was concerned it might mess up my digestive system long term. Having an acidic stomach was important for proper digestion. It was all such a juggling act trying to get my body back in balance. But it worked. From being continually blitzed by bugs, I was suddenly back to my old self. Hurrah! Especially when I added berberine back into my regime. It was also in 2007, digging around for drugs for other cancer patients, that I concluded metformin, a common diabetic drug, would help starve cancer of glucose. And I have since discovered it has many other effects against cancer too, like blocking IGF-1 and mTOR, a key enzyme for cell division, boosting good bacteria in the gut, so also improving immunity, while blocking hexokinase 2, one of the steps in the oxidative phosphorylation pathway, reducing the conversion of lactate back to glucose and increasing insulin sensitivity. Metformin, I decided, was a big gun. It would help boost any cancer-starving diet. But rather than taking it after a meal, as many diabetics do, for cancer patients with normal blood sugar levels, would it not be best to starve the cancer by taking it before meals, before the rise in glucose occurred at all? Timing, just like when to exercise, which I decided was best 15 minutes after meals to reduce insulin and glucose, must be of critical importance. A large part of metformin's effects take place in the gut, in a similar way to berberine, modulating the microbiome, which can be unfavorably altered by both high saturated fat as well as too many simple sugars. Both metformin and berberine improve the number of health-promoting short-chain fatty acids in the gut that reduce inflammation and keep the intestinal barrier intact. Both berberine and metformin were included into my daily regime. I alternated between the two, but occasionally I added them together. Perhaps I should not have done this without a glucometer to check my glucose levels, but I suffered no ill effects. I was not a diabetic, and metformin is normoglycemic. In other words, it doesn't drop glucose levels below normal readings. It is safer than many doctors believe. For years it had been tarred by its more dangerous sister, fenformin. Word was spreading by now that I was a stage 4 survivor and that I might know something about achieving remission in impossible circumstances. I was finding myself taking more and more referrals from friends and friends of friends. I really wanted to put cancer behind me, but I also knew I now possessed valuable information that could help others. Reluctantly, I took on a few cases: kidney, bladder, pancreatic, colorectal, and breast. I tried to stay at arm's length, as researching for them brought back all the bad experiences I was trying hard to forget. I needed to stay detached, so I rarely met the patient and only communicated through emails. Alongside natural and alternative therapies, I found many off-label drugs that might offer benefits to these patients. Propranolol was a beta blocker that would help reduce VEGF, the growth factor that stimulated the growth of new blood vessels to feed cancer. Propranolol also blocked matrix metalloproteinase 2 and 9, MMP2 and MMP9. So it prevented the tissue scaffold around tumor cells breaking down to allow it to metastasize, changing it from being cancer-promoting to becoming cancer-hostile. But it would interact with dipridamol, as both can potentially lower blood pressure. However, dipridamol, I discovered, also blocked MMP9 and blocked Wnt signaling, the latter often altered in cancer. Sulindac was an NSAID that seemed very useful for colorectal cancer, but very difficult to obtain. I encouraged people to make their own spot of bother charts, but it was clear that after a couple of years this arm's-length approach wasn't working, and the list of supplements seemed too long and confusing. What were the big guns, which were the most effective drugs and supplements, and why? People continued to die, and no one was able to get any of these off-label drugs prescribed from their oncologists. I had some spectacular successes, though. 2 stage 4 patients are still alive and very much kicking, as I write, both at least 14 years after their terminal diagnosis, using natural therapies alone. These successes were the ones I'd met in person, Only then had they fully grasped the importance of the low glycemic diet,